UK Wine Show, show number 113. David Paxton on water management. On this week's show, we cast the spotlight into wine and health and find out about alcohols and units of wine. David Paxton gives us a lowdown on water management in Australia and also what the drought means to Australia. And in the news, a court ruling leaves St. Emilion Chateau without classification. Still wine sparkles in the UK wine competition. And Asda selling French wine by the vinload. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 113 for the 11th of July. My name is Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with David Paxton. David is a winemaker in Australia from McLaren Vale, which is still suffering one of Australia's longest and deepest droughts. We talk to David about the drought, water management, and Australian viticulture. As I'm in Australia at the moment, and we sadly don't have Jane to read the news, which is, well, I'm already missing her. Next up, we have the news with me. All the recent buzz surrounding UK wines has been mainly about the quality homegrown sparklers. But now, a still wine is taking top prize in this year's English and Welsh wine competition. Three Choirs Vineyard won the Wine of the Year trophy for their 2006 Estate Reserve Zagreb. Winemaker Martin Folk was also named Winemaker of the Year. Last year's highest award winner, the Camel Valley, scooped the best sparkling wine trophy with its Cornwell White Pinot Noir. And in total, 11 golds, 46 silvers and 74 bronzes were awarded, more than in any of the previous 2 years. Personally, Camel Valley Pinot Noir is a cracker. I tried it a couple of months ago, and I would have bought a fair bit if they'd been willing to sell it. It's only available from the winery. Next week, we're going to be talking to Sam Lindo. He's the winemaker there. He was also named Winemaker of the Year for the 2007 competition. And as you know, we spoke to Martin Folk, the UK Winemaker of the Year, back in show 106. Next up, Asda selling the French wine by the vinload. French wine is back in fashion with consumers at Asda since the supermarket chain gave more shelf space to the country's bottles and introduced some price offers on some of the premium wines. Asda's wine team have been seeing falls in French wine sales across the supermarket in general, but found that consumers were keen to buy good French wines that were displayed prominently in the store. So, Asda decided to give them more space to the French wines, and sales have increased by over 46%. Furthermore, Asda's wine buyer, Michelle King, says, after taste testing a premium wine, which had been on offer, consumers were returning to buy it even when it was at full price. Chablis, Sancerre, and Puy Fumé are among those selling the best by the vinload, according to Michelle, and has been given the retailer an 8.6% share of the French wine market in the UK, up from 5.8% compared to this time last year. And finally, court's ruling leaves St. Emilion Chateau without classification. The St. Emilion classification has been left in a libeling disarray after the Bordeaux court ruled last week that their most recent 2006 classification is invalid. The controversial classification has been a matter for French courts since four chateaus demoted in the 10-yearly review took legal action. Following that, the classification was temporarily suspended in mid-March last year, but then reinstated 8 months later when France's highest administrative court in Paris favoured in the appeal of the INAO, the body that makes French wine classifications, and annulled the suspension on the grounds that the chateau complaints weren't of a nature to question the legality of the entire classification. Last week, the Bordeaux court made its final verdict on whether the contesting chateau had been unfairly treated based on the way the review wine tasting was done. It believes the procedural mechanisms was wrong and that the wine chateaus already classified were tasted separately to those estates not yet classified. The upshot is, the whole classification is void. From my point of view, whether the legality of the system is good or not, at least St. Emilion are willing to review their classification system. The rest of Bordeaux has been pretty much stuck in a time warp since 1855, with only three changes since then. So it's a shame that the system's been shown to be unfair, and they need to do something about it. At least they do change the classification, and the wines reflect the quality being produced, unlike the rest of the Bordeaux. That's pretty much the news this week. Very shortly, we're going to be getting into the spotlight on wine and health. But this month's poll is related to wine and health, and we're asking the question, how many units of alcohol could men and women drink per week to stay within sensible drinking guidelines? This week's poll follows in from last month's question on the number of units in a 25ml glass of wine. And as usual, to have your say, go to 3050.co.uk. You can click on UK Wine Show and monthly poll on the right-hand side of the page. This month's poll is related to this week's spotlight. We discuss what a unit of wine is and what are the recommendations for pregnant ladies. The UK advice to the public is based on a term known as a unit. One unit of alcohol is defined as 10 millilitres or 1 centilitre of alcohol by volume, or 8 grams by weight of pure alcohol. If you go to the 3050 website and go to the podcast section, you'll see a link to this month's spotlight, Wine and Health. And there you can find a whole table that outlines the ABV volume, and you can look up the number of units for any particular quantity of wine. But how much to drink when you're pregnant is a big question. How much a woman can drink when she's pregnant and stay safe is not really known. But it is known that alcohol can damage a developing baby. A small amount probably does no harm. However, the exact amount that is safe is not known. Therefore, to play it safe, advice from the Department of Health is that pregnant women and women trying to become pregnant should not drink at all. And according to the Department of Health pregnancy book, heavy or frequent drinkers can seriously harm their baby's development. When you drink, alcohol reaches your baby through the placenta, but your baby cannot process it as fast as you can and is exposed to greater amounts of alcohol for longer than you are. And too much exposure to alcohol can seriously affect your baby's development and cause fetal alcohol syndrome. Children with this have restricted growth, heart defects, facial abnormalities, and learning and behavioural disorders. The UK's Chief Medical Officer's current advice, which changed in May 2008, is now that pregnant women or women trying to conceive should avoid drinking alcohol. Until May 2008, the advice had been that if you choose to drink to protect your baby, you should not drink more than 2 units of alcohol once or twice a week and should not get drunk. While no new evidence was available to justify the change from a very small amount to none, Dr. Fiona Adshead, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, said that the change was meant to send a strong signal to thousands of women who drank more than the recommended limit that they are putting their babies at risk. The previous advice, to drink in moderation, had been in place for about 10 years. Previously, midwives had regularly told pregnant women to drink up to 8 units a week and even recommended Guinness to prevent anemia. The Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists say there is no evidence that a couple of units once or twice a week will have any harm to the baby, which is inconsistent with the Chief Medical Officer. So, there you have it. In this week's Spotlight, on a personal note, whatever advice you take, if you're pregnant and you intend to drink, research the topic, make your own informed decision. Just remember that no one knows at what point damage will occur, but remember, at some point, too much alcohol will damage your baby, which is significantly more vulnerable to alcohol than you are. So bear that in mind. That ends this week's Spotlight. Next week, we continue our look at wine and health by looking at what the limits are in other countries, including Australia and New Zealand. And Australia is a topic for this week's interview. We're going to be talking with David Paxton from McLaren Vale on the Australian drought and water management in vineyards. But before we jump into the interview, a quick bit of geography. Most of Australia's wine is produced in the southeastern part of Australia. Fair enough, you've got Margaret River on the left-hand seaboard below Perth, but most of it's concentrated around Adelaide, and it's the base for a lot of the famous regions, including Barossa Valley, Eden Vale, and of course, McLaren Vale. But the real engine room of Australian bulk wine is the less talked about regions of Riverina and Riverlands. These form much of the base wine that you'll see for under £6 a bottle. And if the wine says it's from southeastern Australia, there's a fairly good chance that a lot of the wine comes from Riverland and Riverina. This hot region gets all its water from the mighty Murray River, which starts in the Snowy Mountains on the border between Victoria and New South Wales, and winds inland, creating agricultural regions that would otherwise be desert. The Murray River, and the Murray Basin as it's often called, is the lifeblood of much of the wine volume of Australia's viticulture, and its health is a direct relationship to Australia's wine fortunes. So, with that under your belts and a bit of knowledge there, let's have a listen to what David Paxton has to say.
Hi, I'm with David Paxton from Paxton Vineyards in the McLaren Vale, Australia. How are you, David?
I'm very well, thanks, Chris.
Excellent. We're going to be talking about water management within Australia. It's quite a hot topic, Australia being one of the driest places in the world. Not a lot of water there as well. Do you want to just give us an overview of where Australia is in terms of their progression in terms of water management? Because it's something that Aussies generally think a lot more about than, say, us Brits in this, because it's rainy outside and windy at the moment.
Look, it is something that Australians are quite good at, because they have to be. McLaren Vale's in South Australia, which is the driest state in the driest continent. And although most of us live in the coastal strip, which is not totally drought stricken all the time, we have to be extremely mindful of water conservation. We had just gone through a drought which had its zenith last year, which has been as bad as anybody has ever seen. There are no records of it being as dry as it has been.
Has that broken yet? Because I was in Australia just before Christmas and Brisbane got a fair old pelting when I was there.
No, I don't believe it has broken. We are getting torrential rains on the east coast and certainly up in Brisbane, and there is rain falling on some of the catchment areas for the Darling River, which is one of the major rivers that actually feeds into the Murray, which most people have heard about.
Yep.
It is still very scattered and patchy, and there are great areas of Australia which are still in the grip of a pretty horrendous drought.
Okay, the drought, some people in Australia sort of say it's related to El Nino, La Nina, which are sort of weather patterns. And I was told that the weather patterns were just starting to change from one to the other, which generally means it's moving into more of a wetter period. Do you want to give us an overview of what El Nino, La Nina means?
El Nino and La Nina.
La Nina.
One's the male and the other's the female, are to do with tidal movement in the Pacific Ocean, and the actual cooling down and heating up of that those currents, and they have a huge and significant effect on whether we have droughts or quite heavy rains. El Nino is generally considered to be the drought phase, and La Nina is the phase where things are back to what one might call normal, if there is anything normal left in this world.
Yeah. And are we moving into a La Nina?
I'm not aware of that.
Okay.
There have been the climatologists have picked that there is. A little while ago, 18 months ago, that there was a change from El Nino to La Nina. However, they now say that was a false prediction and it started and then stopped. For reasons that they can't explain, or possibly that we don't, humble folk like I don't understand. I'm not being too smart by half. I'm just saying that there is, it's welling up of currents that, but I can't take it in. But at this stage, it's not predicted that there is an immediate break to the drought cycle. Now, during droughts, of course, in Australia, we get phenomenal hailstorms, rainstorms, all sorts of things can happen. In Adelaide, just near where I live, which is the capital city of South Australia, there were areas that got nearly 100 millimetres just recently before we left, and 2 kilometres away, they had zero.
Yes.
So it seems to be the fluky type weather of drought.
Okay. You talked about the Murray getting a bit of river, the Murray River getting a bit of water recently. The Murray feeds a lot of the bulk growing regions of Australia. You've got Riverina, that whole, the Murray-Darling Basin. A lot of people were talking about things like saliency levels in the Murray increasing because of the lack of water. Is that something that you've...
It's all very real, and certainly South Australia being at the end of the Murray, well, the Murray mouth is actually down at near a town called Goolwa, where it runs through a series of lakes and then runs out to sea. Those lakes have receded. They've lost a tremendous amount of water. And you must remember that there's been a fair bit of human intervention with us stopping the seawater from coming into the lakes and all sorts of up and down the Murray-Darling system. There are weirs, which we call locks, and they hold back vast amounts of water for irrigation domestic and consumption. There is a huge amount of reliance on the Murray-Darling system by small cities and rural areas, and this drought has really given everybody pause for thought.
How are you guys in Australia responding to it? I heard you're using some recycled water. What exactly is that all about?
Where we are, we're using recycled water. We at McLaren Vale, we started off our irrigation, which was water was supplied from a basin called the Wollunga Basin. It's quite a strong basin, quite well recharged, and we got into it in the 70s and started pumping like hell, and that was all everybody. And in 1990, we formed a committee realising that we were going to ruin the resource. And we now have an authority which controls it. There are no more licences, and if you want to move a licence, you have to jump through a number of hoops.
Water licences.
I'm sorry. Yes, I'm not I'm speaking as though everybody understands what I'm talking about. But then those licences enable people to take 1.1 megalitre per hectare, so it's quite well controlled. If you want any more, you can have it, but you've got to buy it at quite high dollars, and anything up to $10,000 per megalitre to buy that water. So there is, trading doesn't happen all that often because of it. So what happened was, because McLaren Vale, very close to Adelaide, had only two options. One is become a housing estate or carry on its history, and it was becoming a strategic, it is a strategic viticultural area in Australia. We had to find another resource for water, and so that was recycling town water from a number of nearby small cities, I suppose you'd say, Christie's Beach and O'Sullivan's Beach and a number of beach areas. And that water, which was previously pumped out into the St Vincent's Gulf, our nearest body of water, to some detriment of that, is now processed and delivered to the viticultural areas as clean, usable irrigation water.
Is that sewage water, household water, or is it...
Yes, it's a mixture of everything, including runoff.
Okay.
Of course, but there's the emotive element to sewage water, which that's actually very easy to clean up. It's the runoff water from roads and industrial estates and all that sort of stuff. That's much harder to clean up.
Why is that? Because it's got oil or...?
Oh, it tends to have heavy metals and all that sort of stuff in it. But we now have a system that can take all of that out.
I find it funny that it's, you think sewage water is better than just rainwater.
Yes. I mean, we can't really discuss it on radio too much, but, we have... When you consider London water is probably recycled...
Oh, we drink sewage water here in London.
Six to 11 times. As a visitor to London over many years, it's never concerned me or worried me. I mean, there's a lot of people here, and they all look okay to me. I'm a great supporter of it. It is emotive in Australia, however, but we're getting huge acceptance suddenly because of the drought.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic! I always think of rainwater as being quite clean, I suppose. But I suppose if it's been running through. If you got runoff from the cars, it's cleaning all the roads effectively, isn't it? So all the rubber and
oh, exactly. lead. And rainwater is clean. It's a wonderful product, but yes, it's what it touches on the way through that can affect things.
You mentioned earlier that you had a target of about 1.1 megalitres per hectare of land. Is a megalitre a million litres of water?
Yes, correct.
And that's over a period of a year, is it?
Yes.
Okay. I listened to a presentation you gave earlier. You said originally you were taking something like 6 megalitres per hectare a while ago.
Yeah.
Do you want to just talk a wee bit about how you went from 6 megalitres down to 1.1 and what the big shifts were?
That was the extreme case I used to make the point, when the analysis of the water usage of the district was taken into account and everything was put together, yes, there was one user who was using 6.6 megalitres. We didn't personally use that much. but we were running anything up to 2.5 to 3 megalitres per hectare. And to actually change your cultural methods and your irrigation regime meant that you had to become a clever farmer rather than just saying, we need water, let's turn it on. Now it was, we need water. How much do we need? That had to be analysed. Let's only put on just what we need, no more. Hopefully no less. And so it was done with a great deal of pain, and it's changed the face of McLaren Vale forever and has done nothing but good for increasing the quality of the fruit produced from that area.
I suppose the less water, the higher the concentration of flavours.
Yes, yes. Phil Laffer mentioned that, Australia's focused on producing, vines rather than fruit in the past, and you could say that that's what water does. It produces very big vines, and therefore, your quality's markedly reduced. We now grow pretty small vines with much smaller crops and, quite frankly, with a better result, a more sustainable result, from a quality point of view, from a marketing point of view. To survive in the world of wine where there's so much available, you've got to be pretty smart.
What did you do in the vineyard to reduce it? Were you flood irrigating and then you went to drip irrigation? Or was there any equipment that you had to install, or was it more of a monitoring side of thing?
We've always used drip irrigation, and generally the McLaren Vale District has been a bit of a leader in that department. It's always grabbed innovation and run ahead from some of the other viticultural areas. I don't know why. Certainly there were some sprinklers and a bit of flood irrigation, but generally as irrigation was starting to be used in the late 60s, early 70s and through to the 80s, it started being drip, and now it would be 100% drip irrigation. No, the revolution was really in monitoring that soil moisture, in being able to actually look and see what's happening in the ground and adding water as you needed to. But more importantly, as I mentioned earlier, improving the structure of your soil, improving your cultural methods so that the soil that they're standing up in has the ability to hold a lot more water, a lot more natural rainfall.
Yep.
As well as the irrigation water that you put on doesn't evaporate or just run straight through to the clay layer.
So you're slowing down the water, keeping it where you want it, and it's not running off as much, is it?
Exactly. That's exactly what's happening.
Okay.
Yes. And it's very exciting. I mean, the out of hardships come excitement, if you like.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, Dave, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Chris.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that interview with David. With the 2008 Australian grape harvest up on the dire predictions made in late 2007, the drought has not broken. Next week, we're going to be talking to Sam Lindo from Camel Valley about Camel Valley. And we'll also find out about how he felt being the old 2007 English winemaker of the year and what that did for their sales. Well, to finish up this week, I've given up trying to find some jokes. If you've got some jokes, I'd love to hear them. Please send me any wine-related jokes to chris.scott@ukwineshow.com.
ukwineshow.co.uk. That's UK Wine Show, all one word. With me running out of jokes, I've got a quote. And this one is a quote said by W.C. Fields in My Little Chickadee in 1940s. And it's one of my favourites. During my treks through Afghanistan, we lost our corkscrew. We were compelled to live on food and water alone for several days. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.